In the coming week, the IMF and World Bank convene for their annual spring meetings. North Korea marks a significant anniversary in COVID-19 cases surge across China. It's April 14th, 2022, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Jim Lindsay.
And I'm Carla Robbins, sitting in for Bob McMahon.
Carla is an adjunct senior fellow at the Council, where she leads a roundtable series on national security in an age of disruption. She's also a former guest co-host on The World Next Week. Carla, great to have you back on the show.
Thanks, Jim. It's very fun to be invited back. So let's kick off this week's show by talking about the annual IMF and World Bank spring meeting set to take place in Washington, D.C. this coming April 18th through the 24th. We're expecting they'll feature prominently the recently released World Bank report. What do we need to know about the report in the spring meetings, Jim? And I know they're going to go and snarl D.C. traffic, but are the days of those massive protests outside the bank and fund over?
No signs so far, Carla, of any impending protests. The council office in D.C. is not too far away from the IMF and World Bank headquarters. I haven't seen the authorities start laying down the Jersey barriers and other things for precautions. Partly that may be because these meetings are not entirely back in person. They're going to be held in a hybrid format, so it's not clear how many of the participants are going to be showing up. I will also note that the G20 finance ministers are scheduled to meet on the sidelines of the meeting next week. And I should just point out that this annual spring confab brings together central bankers, finance ministers, private sector leaders, civil society people, and academics to discuss global economic and development goals. And I'll just say, going into this one, what's going to be hanging over all of the conversations is the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the repercussions it has for the global economy. And I'll note that U.S. Secretary of Treasury Janet Yellen has said that the U.S. may boycott certain meetings if Russian officials show up. And the G20 has already signaled that there won't be the typical communique at the end of the meeting, in good part because of the divisions over Russia. But again, the focal point of the meetings is supposed to be the World Bank report and an impending IMF report that will come out next week, looking forward at the world. And basically, the headline there, Carla, is buckle up, expect a lot of turbulence. Obviously, if you're looking particularly at Ukraine and Russia, big downdraft. The estimate, I think, of the World Bank was that Ukraine's GDP is going to fall by 45% this year. Russia's economy is going to contract by more than 10%. Some of the Eastern European countries, which are seeing an influx of refugees from Ukraine, are going to see their economy shrink by double-digit figures. And then, of course, there are the broader repercussions coming out of this, which is going to be disruption in countries that depend upon imports of food and commodities that come out of both Ukraine and Russia. So I think a big part of it is going to be, in essence, how do you mitigate the consequences coming here? Tied to it are two other things. One is COVID, obviously, the disruption it has caused and whether we're going to see flare-ups. I think we're going to talk a little bit more about that later. But also, you have a big issue of we have left a low interest rate environment of the last couple decades. Inflation is up. You're going to see the U.S. Federal Reserve and other central banks raise interest rates, and that is not good for countries that hold a lot of debt that is not fixed. If you are a country that has a variable interest rates, and a lot of them do, all of a sudden you're going to get a much bigger interest bill coming through, and we're seeing some of that already in Sri Lanka, but expect more debt defaults to be on the horizon.
So this seems like it's going to be a pretty grim meeting. And I suppose, two questions I suppose I have. Are they going to have any prescriptions? I mean, they're talking about a debt bomb. You know, is the fund ready to do anything to help it? Particularly, you know, this new, she's not so new now, you know, Georgieva. She sounds like a different leader for the fund. You know, they talk about sustainable debt rather than austerity. She talks about climate. She talks about inequality a lot. But is she really prepared to push and to do anything, particularly because these countries are not only hurting for food? I mean, with interest rates, they're really going to be in deep trouble.
You're exactly right. And I think a debt bomb is an accurate way to phrase it. There's talk of as many as a dozen countries defaulting. And of course, that in turn has other ripple effects. Now, of course, the IMF can try to take steps. It can call for action by the G20. But at the end of the day, what gets done is going to depend upon the willing of the most important economies to want to work together. And right now, we don't have the context for a lot of cooperation among the major powers. You You also have the real problem, I think, that a number of countries, leadership countries, are overwhelmed right now with issues. If you're in the Biden White House, yes, you should be thinking about the debt bomb and what the United States should do about it. But right now, your focus, first and foremost, in the national security sphere, foreign policy sphere, on managing the U.S. and the NATO response to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And, you know, governments are like any other organization. They have bandwidth, maybe impressive bandwidth, but at the end of the day, it's finite bandwidth. And so that's going to be a real question as to what extent you're going to get the U.S. government and partner nations to be able to actually act on the issues that they face.
Although the interconnectedness of these economies and debt, actually, either sovereign debt, banks are involved in it. I mean, you can really mess up the world economy even more with these countries going under. And, you know, Yellen's sort of a big player. You would think that she would have a seat at the table to expand the bandwidth if the problem is really that big.
Well, she certainly does. But again, keep in mind that a big part of her portfolio today is leading on the sanctions effort against Russia. And I imagine she has a pretty full agenda from when she gets up in the morning until she goes to sleep at night. And also the big question here is, what is China going to do? I mean, China has been a big lender to a number of countries, and it's particularly involved in Sri Lanka. And the Chinese have, over the years, shown themselves willing to lend money, but very unwilling to take a haircut when those investments go bad. So that adds another wrinkle in this whole equation. And then again, let's just say, I think we can say that U.S.-Chinese relations right now are not particularly cordial. So you don't have sort of fertile ground in which you can see that kind of collaboration. And, you know, ultimately, while economists, staff experts, the IMF and World Bank can point to how bad things may happen in the economy over there, in national economies, people are really focused on what's happening here. And it can be very hard to make the argument for interconnectedness or how a debt default in Sri Lanka is going to affect a farmer in Iowa when there's the very immediate thing of inflation is up, gas prices are up, food prices are up, and that is roiling politics in the United States and other countries around the world. I mean, the challenges that we face are not limited to the United States when it comes to economic upset.
So, you know, one of the things about the fund role here is to predict how bad things are going to be with the global economy. And the shrinking numbers are really scary because there's also shrinking numbers for the developed economies. And it's not just COVID, it's the blowback from sanctions. Making, you know, in the beginning of this, everybody was sort of waxing lyrical about how we don't have to have kinetic wars. There's a whole new thing here. You know, the influence of financial sanctions is not just going to be Iran, it's going to bring Russia down. And look at how coordinated things can be with multilateral sanctions. Do you think that the lesson is going to be that not just, I mean, Russia's really going to take a hit, not just now, but forever. I was reading a story yesterday about how an entire generation of tech people are leaving Russia. But there's enormous blowback for us as well and for Europe. Do you think the lesson here is that we're never going to try this again?
Oh, no, I think we will try it again precisely because sanctions are more appealing as a response to military action than military action is. But we've often, over the years, held up sanctions as a magic wand that it can force or compel countries to change their behavior. And the history of sanctions is that they generally don't produce those outcomes. And they don't produce those outcomes for a variety of reasons. One is that countries learn to adapt. Two, countries are willing to absorb pain. You may remember Prime Minister Ali Bhutto of Pakistan famously said that Pakistanis would eat grass if they had to get nuclear weapons. So you have that ability. And then you have the third problem, which is that sanctions can be very difficult to enforce consistently, precisely because of what you pointed to, Carla. There's blowback. And so if you look in Eastern Europe, you look in Western Europe right now, they're grappling with the fact that some of the sanctions that are on the table or maybe on the table, think oil and gas sanctions, are going to hurt their own economies. And you have to make those calculations. How do you want to trade off your desire to want to penalize the Russians, try to coerce the Russians into exiting Ukraine versus the fact that your unemployment rates may go up, your cost of living may go up, and that's going to create domestic political unrest that will feed throughout the political system. So I think these are the decisions that sort of go back and forth. But again, sanctions don't have a great track record of compelling countries to say uncle. If they they did, Iran would not have a nuclear weapons program today.
Although one might conversely say, if they were total failure, they wouldn't have come to the table in the first place. I do think these are different sort of sanctions. I mean, this is, I don't think anyone ever expected the Europeans to even go as far as they did.
Oh, you're quite right. I mean, they can be fairly described as crippling. And I do think for Russia over the long term, they are going to have immense repercussions. It is really going to hobble the Russian economy. It's going to drive Russia further into the arms of China as a junior partner, really as a commodity supplier, particularly of oil and gas. But that's not the goal of the sanctions. The goal of the sanctions is to get Russia to stop its war in Ukraine. And right there, we don't see that happening, which is why you see Western countries and not just NATO providing such a wide range of arms to Ukraine, hoping that Ukraine can on its own make the cost of the war on its soil so high that Russia will be compelled to quit. And so far, we haven't seen that happen either.
Can you spell Versailles Treaty? I mean, the sort of the impact on Russia for who knows what Russia is going to come out of it with. A destroyed Russia, maybe an even more frightening Russia.
Exactly right. And that's why when people start talking about regime change in Russia, there's no guarantee that that will take us to a better spot either. Definitely very difficult, very turbulent times that we live in. And I think the era of globalization that really kicked off after the fall of the Soviet Union has come to an end, and we're in a new era of world politics. With that said, Carl, let's switch gears and turn our attention to an upcoming anniversary in North Korea. It's gaining a lot of attention outside of North Korea. And I'm thinking here of the 110th anniversary of Kim Il-sung's birthday. It comes tomorrow, and there's a lot of speculation that Pyongyang may celebrate the anniversary of Kim Il-sung's birthday by conducting a nuclear test. Can you give us a sense of why in North Korea events like this lead to things like nuclear tests?
You know, I've been looking at my phone as you're talking because tomorrow, it's almost Friday there. And, you know, these guys are really into anniversaries. And not only is this week Grandpa's birthday, it's also the 10th anniversary of Kim Jong-un's ascension. And this year in February was, it's also the 80th anniversary of Dad's birthday. And they have a tendency, they're really into the theater of these things. And this has also just been a year of them acting out. There's a raft of missile tests, more than a dozen, including the first full ICBM test since 2017. So why is everyone predicting that, you know, what would be, I think, the seventh nuclear test, the first since 2017 to happen? Well, first, there's a lot of action around the nuclear complex, the one that was supposedly destroyed back in 2018 as part of that love fest with President Trump.
So it wasn't destroyed, I take it.
Yeah, it's sort of a shock, isn't it? Satellite photos show signs of construction or reconstruction at the Pungyi Ri underground testing site. An analysis done by the Colorado School of Mines of NASA satellite photos of the Yang nuclear complex has shown, I love this, a 30% rise in nighttime lights above the 2017 average. As scary as this is, I love how analysts do this work, suggesting that they have may have resumed their fuel production. The IAEA said, also reported last year, that they believe the North Koreans had restarted that reactor that leads to the production of plutonium fuel for their weapons cores. So Intel says there's a lot of action going on there, both in the testing site and in the fuel production. And second, you know, this is just the basic pattern for this government. Nobody puts baby in the corner. You know, the world's attention is someplace else, and especially Washington's attention is someplace else. And Kim doesn't like it. He wants to get back in the spotlight. You know, the Biden administration has been pretty low-key to these provocations. It says it's open to talks with no preconditions, and Pyongyang has so far showed no interest. That's sort of this really interesting thing. Whether Biden actually would get into talks if they showed interest, I don't know, but the North Koreans have a long history of cranking things up. The one thing that the U.S. has done in the last few days is to send an aircraft carrier strike group, the Abraham Lincoln, into the waters between South Korea and Japan. So we're sending a message that we're paying attention, but not probably as much as the North Koreans want.
So what would the significance of a seventh nuclear test be, Carla, given that they've done six of them already? Is there something meaningful that results from such a test, or is it more symbolic as a way, as you say, to let everybody know that baby is still around?
Well, Well, every time they test, they get better at it. We don't know exactly, you know, we can look at from the Temblers, you know, the size of it. They're certainly developing their missile capabilities. I mean, the things that they really need to perfect are the, you know, warheads and whether they can put warheads that can survive reentry. And a test isn't necessarily going to forward that. So from a technological point of view, probably not. I would say right now, though, it really matters, particularly in South Korea, because the South Koreans who have been really itchy for a long time looking up at China and looking up at North Korea saying, why don't we have a weapon? And another test is just going to add to that. And they're looking real close at Ukraine. And they're saying to themselves, Ukraine had weapons on its soil. They let them go away and look what happened. We had weapons on our soil until 1991. They were American weapons. We let them get away. You know, maybe we need to do something to guarantee our own defense. I think one of the last polls I saw said something like 71% of South Koreans say they want to have nuclear weapons of their own. So anything that cranks up that pressure, particularly in the context of what's going on in Ukraine, is not a good thing for nuclear nonproliferation. So I would say that's probably, for me, the number one issue. Missile tests make me in many ways more nervous because, you know, they shoot them over Japan. What happens if something goes wrong and one of these things tumbles and, you know, hits a farmhouse or kills a cow or something like that? Then you got to start thinking about retaliation or how you deal with it. And that has also a very potentially destabilizing effect. So, you know, you don't want to mess around with nukes and missiles.
Well, I will note two things. One, that North Korea is a heavily sanctioned country and continues to pursue the behaviors that the sanctions are intended to deter.
Jim, you're always right.
Well, I'm not trying to be right or wrong. It's just another example of to note that sanctions are used because we're very concerned about the consequences of using military force, hoping we can find this economic tool that can give us the outcome we desire. And this is another case in which it hasn't worked. But putting that aside, Carla, second thing is we have a new president about to be sworn in South Korea. How do you think that might play out, given that he's a conservative and has been very critical of the existing government, President Moon's government, with its attempts to do sunshine policy and open a dialogue with the North?
Well, he's a hardliner. I mean, I think one of the reasons why that carrier group is there is that, you know, he sent his representatives to the White House and said, please, you know, send something, do it. So that too cranks up the tensions. And, you know, I don't know whether he's going to take a stand and say we need nuclear weapons, but, you know, the tensions rise there and the pressure for the U.S. to make a stronger commitment rises there. You know, I don't think the Biden administration particularly wants to sit down and push for the sunshine policy. At the same time, I don't think they want a full-blown crisis on the Korean Peninsula, because they certainly, you were talking about bandwidth issues. This really is a bandwidth issue.
Agreed.
And on the sanctions issue, I mean, I think it was Holbrooke said sanctions is the things you do between going to a full-out war and just beating your chest.
That's a good description of it. I think there's a lot of truth to that.
But there's also, I was just looking right now, there was a Reuters story about 15 hours ago that said the U.S. pushes UN to cut North Korea oil imports, ban tobacco to North Korea, and blacklist the Lazarus Hackers Group. You know, there's not a lot of tools. And there is, you know, once again, this very interesting debate that's going on in the nonproliferation field right now. How do we make the argument that nuclear weapons are not a useful thing to have? Because the North has nuclear weapons. We now know they have nuclear weapons. So everybody has very limited tools to wrestle them back from what they have. And there is this whole demonstration effect with Ukraine, not only for the South Koreans to say we want nuclear weapons, but for the North Koreans to say, why should we ever give up nuclear weapons? If, you know, the U.S. doesn't want to put troops on the ground in Ukraine to protect the Ukrainians, even in the face of these incredible war crimes, you know, we're safe for all time, certainly. There's no regime change going to be forced on us here, you know, except for sanctions. So, you know, there's a whole debate now. All the nonproliferation people, of which I consider myself one, are saying, no, nonproliferation is a good thing. But the demonstration effect here is a pretty frightening one. And there is all of the reasons for why we should be worried about them testing right now, particularly in the midst of this conflict.
Well, your point's well taken about North Korea wanting to keep its nuclear capability because it is the shield to fend off the United States or anyone else. On the issue of South Korea, the South Koreans clearly do, and you were right with the public opinion polls, show much more interest in having a nuclear capability, but they're going to be hamstrung to acquire one without the consent of the United States, given a whole variety of agreements between the two countries. But that doesn't mean that the South Koreans can't maneuver themselves into what's sometimes referred to as a just-in-time capability or develop many of the precursors. So if they decided that they were going to acquire it, they could do so quite quickly. Many people suggest or assume that Japan, for example, if it were to make a decision to acquire nuclear weapons, and that is an even more controversial issue in Japan for obvious reasons, could do so in short order, just given the sophistication and the great range of the Japanese industrial complex.
Although I think we have much more control over South Korea's capacity to, you know, deal with their fuel cycle than Japan does. I was in northern Japan at one point where they have a plant that's, you know, they separate plutonium because someday they think they're going to, you know, they're going to burn it again with some weird, you know, perpetual motion machine, this mixed oxide fuel. But, you know, they're just sitting on a mound of this stuff. Yes. And they are truly a virtual nuclear power. And that's something else we have to worry about. Certainly, you know, the Japanese, having been the only people who are the victims of, you know, two nuclear weapons, have a much stronger reason to not want to go there. But there's certainly been an argument in Japan as well, as they've watched, you know, North Korea and watched China, because China, too, is building up its nuclear arsenal.
And obviously, if you are a leader in Tokyo or Seoul or elsewhere, you have to wonder about the persistence of the American commitment to defend you. And if you begin to believe that the United States is either going to go it alone or turn inward and adopt an isolationist policy, you don't want to be left on an island by yourself, because you also can read the example of Ukraine as suggesting that if you had nuclear weapons, that Ukraine would still be intact. Now, we can argue whether that would have been the case or not, but that's certainly, I think, the lesson that many people are suggesting leaders should draw from what's transpired over the last 2 months.
Although, you know, for the South Koreans, there's a really fundamental difference. I mean, there was no, you know, commitment to Ukraine, and Seoul and Washington do have a mutual defense treaty. Yep. But the South Koreans, their confidence in, you know, that commitment was pretty shaken by the Trump administration's threats to draw down U.S. troops unless they, you know, they were basically holding them hostage for more money. And that confidence, you know, is the Trump issue hangs over all these relationships.
And hanging over this is the concern that in January 2025, Donald Trump will come back as president, or somebody with views similar to Donald Trump's. And then again, you're back in the situation where, as a country allied to the United States, you're worried that alliance is going to go away, and that's going to affect everybody's calculations.
Well, Jim, let's switch gears and talk about China. Average daily COVID-19 cases have surged to over 25,000 per day, which has been driven by a spike, particularly in Shanghai. And while most of the world seems to be easing their lockdown restrictions, perhaps wrongly, it seems as though China's really tightening theirs. Can you break down for us what's happening in China right now, Jim?
Certainly, Carla. I mean, the first thing that's striking is that China is in the process of imposing severe lockdowns when it has an average of 25,000 new cases a day. And here in the United States, we're averaging about 29,000 cases a day for a population that is about one-third the size of China. And our numbers undoubtedly understate the case level because we don't do a lot of testing. And we're viewing this period as a respite from the really bad times of COVID. And those discrepancies reflect the fact that China has been pursuing, since the start of the pandemic, this zero tolerance policy. They have reacted very strongly wherever there have been outbreaks of the virus to quarantine not just neighborhoods and cities, but entire cities, disconnecting them from the rest of the country in a bid to isolate the cases. And that worked reasonably well for the first year of the pandemic. The Chinese, I think, threw their shoulder out of joint, patting themselves on the back as to how well that had worked. But two problems arose. One, the vaccines that the Chinese distributed around their country haven't been as effective as some of the vaccines developed in the West. And second, the virus mutated, and you now have a much more contagious variant. And what China has done is, in essence, turned its country into dry tinder, and a fire has started. You have a very transmissible virus that is not deflected by the two Chinese vaccines. And so the Chinese are having to crack down ever more to try to prevent the spread. And right now, Shanghai, a city of, I think it's 25 million people, is basically everyone's locked indoors. And it's amazing to see pictures on Instagram of major thoroughfares in Shanghai with no cars, streets with no people. And of course, a number of people in Shanghai are bristling against the intensity of this lockdown. You have people lives disrupted, but running out of food, having medical problems, not being able to attend to them and the like. And this has been an issue. Now, you might say, well, why doesn't China sort of abandon the zero tolerance policy as every other country in the world has done and rely on vaccines to do so? And that's probably really good advice. It doesn't appear to be advice that President Xi has taken. Indeed, he gave a speech yesterday in which he, in essence, said he was going to double down on his zero tolerance policy. And the problem is this has big repercussions because he's actually undermining the Chinese economy. I mean, Shanghai is, I think, the largest port in the world. It handles like 3 or 4 times more traffic than, let's say, the port of Los Angeles here in the United States. And so that disrupts the global supply chains, but it also disrupts internal Chinese supply chains. And you're seeing many people worrying that China's economy is not going to grow at the predicted 5 or 6%. It's going to be a lot less. And now you're hearing people start making an analogy to some of Mao's policies back in the 50s and 60s, and particularly to Mao's effort to exterminate sparrows. Back in the late 1950s, Mao apparently had an aversion to sparrows, thought that they were a pest, called upon the Chinese people to kill sparrows. Chinese, in a burst of patriotic duty, went out and killed as many sparrows as possible. Estimates of something like 2 billion sparrows being killed. So they achieved Mao's goal. But in doing so, they created a very big problem, which was that sparrows ate bugs, lots of bugs. No sparrows, many more bugs. And that contributed to the Great Famine. So the notion here is the country sort of following a leader with great power down a road that leads to much bigger problems. Now, we don't know exactly how this is all going to play out. Maybe President Xi's bet will pay off, that if you're willing to impose these intense lockdowns, that you can actually keep your country from getting infected. But you know, this virus is persistent. It is contagious. It is going to continue to mutate. And if that's the case, and for anything I hear from epidemiologists and virologists, that is the case, China is going to be playing essentially a whack-a-mole strategy for a very long time. And that is going to have all kinds of consequences.
So whacking moles and whacking sparrows. So why is she doing this? I mean, we were having a conversation yesterday about some of the lessons from Ukraine that other countries are taking around the world, and Putin isn't listening to his advisors.
Does Putin have advisors?
Well, that may be the case. I mean, is he so out of touch with what's going on that he doesn't know what's going on? He doesn't know the reaction of his own people? Is this just a statement, because it's a very political year for him, that he's going to prove once again the superiority of I can control things, authoritarianism, the Chinese model is so much better than the lax West. They may figure out how to coexist with COVID, but going to the mattresses, authoritarianism is really the thing that can do it? Or is this really just, you know, the delusion of authoritarianism, that they really think they can control things when they can't do it?
Probably all of the above, Carla. I mean, I think is a fundamental part of human nature where it is difficult to admit a mistake. And I think that is intensified in any authoritarian government where feedback loops are cut off and you have authoritarian leaders who are used to people, in essence, telling them what they want to hear. And again, you know, from Xi's point of view, for the first 12 months, maybe the first 24 months of the pandemic, this zero tolerance policy worked reasonably well. And again, you know, even though China's having these problems, the Chinese claim, if you believe their numbers, that very few people are dying from COVID, and that if they just sustain this pace, they will be able to come out of it on the other side. And again, Chinese will point and say, we didn't have the death toll that you had. We didn't have the morbidity that you have. We're not going to have potentially the long-term consequences of COVID for health that you have. And we've just made sort of a different selection on the trade-off spectrum. But again, the problem for the Chinese is it's clear that, again, in the sparrow analogy, that pursuing this zero tolerance policy just creates lots of other problems that could come back to haunt them. And it's significant because, as you point out, big year for Xi. We're expecting that in October at the big party Congress, he's going to get a third term, basically breaking the 2-term limit that's been in place for the last several several decades in Chinese politics. But the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party really rests not on ideology, nobody believes in Marxism anymore, but rests on the ability to deliver economic progress. And if that goes away, then President Xi is going to have a very, very big challenge going forward, which is why you'll hear some voices out there. George Soros, I think last month, perhaps the most prominent person talk about it, suggesting that this fall may not go as well for President Xi as he anticipated, precisely because all of these problems are bubbling up and they're in essence trying to keep the lid on those pots, and they're going to be unable to do so. We'll see if that turns out to be the case.
So one pot they did not keep the lid on was they were actually, you know, according to the reports, they were separating kids from their parents and putting, if kids got sick and their parents weren't sick, they were putting these kids in quarantine, and they gave up on that one. They allowed the not sick parents to go into quarantine with them. I mean, you would think in China, where children are just absolutely sacred, after another crazy policy, the one child policy, that they back down on this. It'll be interesting to see, particularly if all those really rich people in Shanghai get really pissed off, because you know, I was reading this story, I think yesterday or today, about, you know, people in these, you know, $300 suits out in their high rise, you know, backyards trying to dig up bamboo shoots to eat. It'll be interesting to see whether they really are going to keep the lid on the people who are the engines of their, you know, financial economy and all that. I mean, they're apparently really, really angering a lot of pretty powerful people and pretty base people, the people who refer to as the base of the party.
Well, you're right. But I think what we have seen over the last several years in Xi's China is that Xi is willing to use the power of the state to crush people who speak out against him. And he has sidelined a lot of very powerful and very wealthy people. Think of all of the Chinese entrepreneurs who were riding high 4, 5, 7 years ago, who've now been sidelined by Xi. Now, that will probably have longer term consequences for the Chinese economy that Xi doesn't anticipate. But I think, at least in the near term, probably likely that Xi is going to get his way. He's going to use the power of the state to squelch any dissent. And if this does undermine his rule, it will probably take some time before that happens. But Carl, listen, we've gotten to the point of our show where we want to discuss the audience figure of the week. I want to remind our listeners that you can vote on or tweet us your suggestion for an audience figure of the week at CFR_org. This week, Carla, our audience selected Pakistan's new prime minister. Bob and I talked a little bit about Pakistan last week on the show. Carla, what's happened since then?
Well, I suspect the reason people are focused on this is it's much about watching Imran Khan, the previous prime minister, and very glamorous, you know, former international cricket star being voted out than it is about seeing Shahbaz Sharif, who is not glamorous at all, getting voted in. Sharif is, everybody may remember the name, the younger brother of Nawaz Sharif, who was, I think, 3 times prime minister in Pakistan. And he comes from a family that has been accused time and time again of corruption. And I don't think he's going to have a very easy time of it. Pakistan is going to hold elections by the end of the year. The economy is in really deep trouble, very high inflation, a huge national debt. They are a debt bomb. Pakistani voters still want someone to attack government corruption, which is something that Sharif is not going to be a credible steward of. He almost certainly is going to try to repair relations with the U.S. Khan was on an anti-Washington tear, which is one of the reasons he lost support of the military and ultimately the parliament. But Khan isn't going anywhere. He's already holding rally, and he's going to eagerly pounce on anything that plays into his claim that the U.S. and Sharif conspired to drive him from office. So there's a lot to watch there. And the other thing is that Khan's former wife, who's really glamorous too, is already making fun of him. So if you're into the gossip, watch this space.
Okay, I have to ask, since we're talking about Pakistan, it shares a border with another nuclear armed power, namely India. When we start talking about Pakistan trying to improve relations with the United States, I immediately imagine that people in India both get alarmed and angry. There's a lot of discontent in India about the relationship the United States has had with Pakistan over the years, the support it has provided Pakistan on a military front and otherwise. How do you see the ascension of this new prime minister playing into that triangular conversation?
Honestly, I don't know. I mean, right now, you know, Modi's playing this game that has got to be annoying Washington an enormous amount, because he's refusing to take a position on Russia. He's suddenly gone all non-aligned. And there's a lot of concern in Washington about this rise of once again, of Hindu nationalism that Modi's doing very, very little to screw back on. So one could think potentially that if Sharif wants to cozy up more to Washington, that Modi's going to have more to worry about, because Modi is part of the Quad and he's been stroked a lot by the Biden administration, but there's a lot of reason not to stroke him right now. So maybe he will not be annoyed by it. Maybe he'll be a little threatened by it, which wouldn't be a bad thing.
Okay, I think we are indeed going to have to watch this space.
And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Russian Oil and Gas Week takes place in Moscow. Syrians mark National Day. And the anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic is remembered.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. The articles, books, and podcasts mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you as always, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch, Nicholas Martinez, and Rafaela Seward for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. And I want to thank my good friend and colleague, Carla, for coming in and subbing for Bob McMahon this week.
This is Carla Robbins saying goodbye.
And this is Jim Lindsay saying so long and be well.